HW Media.
Spy Talk, a podcast at the intersection of intelligence, foreign policy, national security, and military operations with Jeff Stein and Gene Meserve.
Welcome to a special edition of the Spy Talk podcast. I'm Jeff Stein. My guest today is Mark Polymeropoulos, a 28-year veteran of the CIA's Clandestine Services Directorate. Much of Mark's career was spent in the Middle East, where he not only conducted highly classified counter-terror missions, but cultivated close relationships over the years with princes, kings, prime ministers, and tribal leaders across the region. Those relationships are key to helping the U.S. successfully navigate between the dangerous shoals of Middle East politics. Alas, he says, the CIA no longer prizes such regional expertise and experience, opting instead for developing generalists among its spy corps, skilled operators who can be and are being constantly shifted among regions. 1 year is a tour in the Middle East. 2 years later, it's China, Africa, or Latin America. That's no way to run a railroad or a spy service, he says. In our interview, which was conducted last month before Israel and Hamas erupted in a tragic new round of fighting, he lamented the passing of Charlie Seidel, whom he called the CIA's last great Arabist. Mark, you're a 26-year veteran of the CIA, mostly in the operations division and mostly in the Middle East and South Asia. Recently, you wrote a piece that lamented the death of Charlie Seidel, who you called the last great Arabist. That's a pretty troubling. It sounds ominous, like the CIA no longer has someone devoted to understanding the culture and speaking the languages, particularly Arabic. So can you explain that?
Sure. Well, first and foremost, I wrote it to honor Charlie Seidel, who was a mentor of mine. He was one of the great CIA officers, of his time. He was a titan in the Middle East. I mean, when I talk about, his ability to kind of walk through the capitals and the palaces of the region and relate to not only the kings and prime ministers and queens, but also the street sweeper. I mean, he was really a tremendous figure. But I call him the last great American Arabist because I think we have lost this level of expertise, and there's a variety of reasons for it. But first and foremost, I did it really to honor a man who, he left the agency not on great terms, and I think it's high time that he get a lot of praise.
Well, how can it be that we have lost expertise on the Middle East at his degree after so many years, decades now, fighting in the Middle East?
So there's a couple things. First, it's the system that we have created, and there's good reasons for this, and we can talk about it, is kind of a move away from that regional expert in which you spent, your entire career overseas. Charlie actually never served at headquarters, which is pretty remarkable. Mm-hmm. But for reasons, and some of them there's some backing to this, is that we moved away from, having officers, men and women who spent their career in one area, and we moved to kind of more of a generalist profile in which, you were supposed to go out overseas, you come back, you do some headquarters time to learn about Washington, learn about the intelligence community, learn about, the managing the bureaucracy back in Washington. And then perhaps you go to other regions of the world. And frankly, it's not only the CIA that's done this, the State Department has this model as well. I was talking to a former ambassador, in fact, this morning, and he was lamenting the same thing, that the State Department has moved away from that. And so I think that with Bill Burns set to be hopefully confirmed next week as the next CIA director, if Ted Cruz ever lifts the hold, it's kind of ridiculous. But this is something that Bill Burns, I think, should take a look at. Can we go back to really having these regional experts? Because for a variety of reasons, one, for the expertise that is required, but also what an ambassador to the Middle East Charlie was. You know, I talk about all the time that, you know, not only was he smart, not only did he advise, you know, numerous CIA directors and State Department personnel as well as U.S. presidents, but also he was an ambassador to the region. The Arab world loved him because he loved the Arab world and he understood them. And I think we've lost that a bit.
Well, that sounds terrible to me. It seems to me an intelligence officer needs to, an effective intelligence officer in the field where you're recruiting agents, people to spy, locals, to give us secrets that we need to know to protect ourselves, that you need to know the language, you need to know the culture. But let's just back up a step. What does it mean to be an Arabist? Explain that in plain words.
Sure. So, you know, I think, you know, it's a really interesting term. I think Robert Kaplan wrote a book several, you know, many, many years ago called The Arabist, when he talked about, it was really focused more on State Department, but there's a long line of Arabists in the CIA as well. I was actually worried that the article I wrote recently would offend some state folks, but I think they understood that I was talking about CIA personnel. But look, an Arabist is someone who has incredible knowledge of not only language, and you know, you can go through a two-year Arabic program. We have a lot of Arabic speakers. That's not really what I'm talking about as much. But I'm talking about those who understand the culture, but who also have had time on the ground and built those relationships. You have to remember, in the Middle East, Middle Eastern intelligence services, their personnel never change. You know, Middle Eastern governments, this is not, you know, administrations that come and go, presidents that come and go, and every 4 years they switch up, you know, the national security apparatuses like we do in our country. In the Middle East, everybody stays the same. And so if you build those relationships over 5, 10, 15, 20 years, that's an incredible, you know, knowledge base you have, a mm-hmm. Rolodex you have. Mm-hmm. Because when you know, push comes to shove and problems need to be solved in the region, you have to turn to individuals such as Charlie Seidel, who could go quietly to Riyadh, to Cairo, to Amman, talk to the leadership, work things out. And you know, by not having that, you know, certainly we lose a tool in our toolbox.
And you can't pick that up in a short period of time. I've often said that after studying Vietnamese intensively for a year and then running an operation on the ground in Vietnam for a year, that I didn't really understand the country until about the day I left. I mean, it takes years to get this understanding. It's incomprehensible to me how someone can be an effective intelligence officer over a period of years without understanding the culture and the language.
Well, that's right. And so it's culture, it's language. It's also serving in different parts of the Arab world. The Gulf is different than the Levant, is different than North Africa. And so you kind of build up that expertise, you build up those ties. You know, I'll never forget, and let me just say, you know, I have a lot of, you know, I say this very humbly, I was not a Charlie Seidel. My Arabic was pretty lousy. I spent some time in the region, but I do remember times where we would have a trilateral meeting of intelligence services, and I won't even say which services they were, but I knew everybody in the room. I knew, you know, it was the United States and two other Middle Eastern services, and just having that foundation of trust. Now, again, we're going to have substantive differences. Our policies probably will be different, but you have that trust. And I think, again, that's based on time on the ground. Charlie Seidel's funeral several years ago was extraordinary. It was held in Fairfax, Virginia. It was like walking into a Star Wars bar of the Middle East with officials from the Arab world, from the U.S. military, from the intelligence community, from the Department of State, who kind of all gathered together to celebrate this man who had such, you know, such a profound effect on everybody in their own kind of personal way. I tell a story about when I came back from Iraq. We were together in Iraq within the invasion in 2003, and I came back and I wasn't well. I had a pretty serious case of post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD. And I called Charlie up and I said, I'm not doing so great. I'm waking up with nightmares. I see dead bodies. And he said, all right, here's what we're going to do. We're going to gather the whole team together at his, you know, at his cottage in Cape Cod. And so we did. And so all of us who were on that original team went for, and he said, we're going to go for 2 weeks. And he arranged for everyone to have rental properties. And we sat around and ate lobsters and drank beer and went, and our families were all with us. He got it. He understood that, you know, this was, you know, the agency was a family and he wanted to take care of all of us. And so he really had just that kind of unique ability to relate to his officers as well, those who were under his command.
I'm talking with Mark Polymeropoulos, a 28-year veteran of the CIA's Clandestine Services Directorate, much of it spent in the Middle East. You write in that piece that Charlie was not treated well at the end of his career at CIA. Tell us what happened.
So that's I'll leave the details of that, in the background. I think the point that I'm making and that I think Bill Burns is something that he has to tackle is that there is a strange phenomenon that happens in CIA that even the most accomplished officers, when they leave, often don't leave with a good taste in their mouth. We call the retired CIA officer cadre, called the formers. But there's a strange pattern of leaving in less than kind of gracious terms, and that doesn't need to be that way. There's the old adage that you can't love the job because it won't love you back. But CIA was not just a job. I mean, it's not a 9-to-5 job. It is all encompassing, where you are tasked to go do very unique things, but your families are involved together. It's pretty extraordinary, and so I think there's a way we can do things better. And so one of the things that I've certainly have called for publicly is a different approach to what we call the formers, in that, people don't have to leave disgruntled or angry. You have to leave with your head held high and celebrated. And I think one of the things that's going to happen with Charlie is we'll finally celebrate him at a ceremony at headquarters whenever COVID ends. It's something that I think a lot of us pushed for, and I'm glad that the leadership there has agreed to do this.
Yeah, in the news business, it used to be said, at least in old-fashioned newsrooms, that the news business will always disappoint you. Is this something about the CIA, or is it about intelligence work that you end up at the end of your career leaving with a sour taste in your mouth?
I think John Le Carré would appreciate that. I mean, I don't know. It doesn't have to be that way. I will say that you brought something up really interesting, because it's maybe a bit of a tangent on. But what I found in my career as a former now, as I've become more active writing and meeting journalists, Jeff, like yourself, who I've really related to it and become my friends, is the parallels between life as a case officer and life as a journalist are extraordinary. I had an amazing conversation recently with a pretty famous foreign correspondent. And when we talked about this in great detail. And so if you look at, those who cover the conflicts, and, when you're talking about whether it's from Vietnam to Afghanistan to Iraq to Syria, what does a journalist do? A journalist cultivates sources who a lot of times they have to protect for their own safety. What does a journalist do? A journalist sees things that others won't see, covers kind of the dark part of the world. Mm-hmm. And you have this fundamental desire to tell the truth. And if you walk into CIA headquarters, on the right is our famous, the stars, the memorial wall. On the left is a biblical verse where it says, you shall know the truth and the truth shall make you free. The parallels between the two professions, I think, are really profound. I would only argue that, just as you said, if journalists are leaving their profession at the end of the career a little disgruntled, it doesn't have to be that way. Same thing with the CIA. We have to celebrate people who really, put a lot into it, because it's certainly not a 9-to-5 job.
Well, let's talk about speaking truth to power. What was Charlie's position on the U.S. invasion of Iraq? Was that something he was?
Well, that's a great question. Charlie was an expert on Iraq, and one of the things, and as he was a mentor of mine, I became immersed in, as a junior officer, immersed in Iraqi operations. And so over the years, he pulled me into this. And his fact is, we were putting the team together that went into Baghdad, which specifically for the high value target hunt. I remember the deck of 55, the Iraqi regime figure. So I was one of the case officers and the case officer chosen to go with him. And it was a great honor. But I'll tell you, as we were going through the city, and I allude to it a bit in my piece, and I think the best account I can tell you about is Robert Draper's recent book on the Iraq War and the failings of the Bush administration, is that Charlie, while he might have been a proponent in bringing down Saddam, certainly was not a proponent and did not advise doing things such as disbanding the entire Iraqi military or firing the Ba'ath Party or things that really the catastrophic mistakes. In fact, him and I, certainly were interested in trying to reconstitute an Iraqi government made up of technocrats. You had the individuals within the regime of Saddam Hussein who certainly committed war crimes, but you couldn't fire the entire government or the entire military. And so I think, as I look back at my discussions with Charlie, just personally, I think he was dismayed on what occurred. And that's an argument that I'm comfortable with having you know participated really in the events in Iraq is that not necessarily that are, you know, clearly the whole issue of the weapons of mass destruction and the intel failure, that's not for one for myself, as I wasn't involved in that, and perhaps it's a cop out saying it, but I wasn't. But I'm talking about as we went in and trying to do the right thing as after we entered the after the invasion. Boy, the United States made terrible mistakes, but they didn't. You know, the Bush administration and the neocons who really kind of drove policy did not listen to Charlie, and I think that it was to really negative effect.
Let's talk about him again as the last great Arabist. You can't bake up instant Arabists. So even though we both grant that there's a need for CIA generalists in the field, somebody who can take his skills from the Middle East to Latin America or wherever. Right. Well, first of all, do you think this problem has infected also the East Asia division? Used to be full of China many years ago. It was full of China experts, Vietnam experts, people who had lived in the region, worked on the region for years and years and years. They seem to be gone now. So this is across the board, not just in the Middle East, but in other regions where we just aren't developing or giving license to people to pursue a career in that specialty of that region.
Right. So I think you have to move away from what I called before is this phenomenon of becoming a generalist. Of you know, if you learn a language, you go serve in a region, you're really smart, and you're serving in Cairo, and then your next assignment's in Paraguay. I mean, that doesn't make any sense. Or it makes some sense in that maybe you want to take a break. But the focus on that region, it's just not there. And I think we have to get back to that. And it's not difficult. It's just a change in mindset once again. It's just a matter of you know, the intelligence community leadership understanding that this is what you have to do. Again, you can train someone, you know, we go through a 2-year Arabic program. Got it. You can put a lot of officers, you know, who have, you know, very functional Arabic on the ground. But again, it's not having 10, 15 years in the region in multiple countries and multiple different parts of the Arab world. So to me, this is not a terribly difficult fix. It's just going to take a different mindset. And you know, there's a theory that a lot of people subscribe to, that you have to come back to headquarters for a substantial amount of time to become this kind of all-encompassing, you know, intelligence officer. Perhaps you don't need to do that for everybody. You know, again, Charlie never served a day in Washington. And so sure, maybe you come home for a tour or two, but you know, you don't have to spend half your career overseas and half in Washington. When you sign up for kind of the Secret Service, silent service, the agency, you know, I think a lot of people do so hoping they're going to spend the next 20 years living in a region.
I have a feeling. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, go ahead.
I have a feeling that Bill Burns will be sympathetic to this argument. But will there be institutional resistance to this idea of encouraging specialization again?
Jeff, there's institutional resistance when they want to change the you know the type of food at the cafeteria. Come on, it's a giant bureaucracy. So sure, there might be, and people can make some cogent arguments on why you do need to kind of have a broader scope. But I think, I think when you look at the risk versus gain, you know, we have to go back to that. But you know, the idea of bureaucratic resistance, sure, there's bureaucratic resistance when you try to do anything new. Look, here's the bottom line, and I talk about intelligence, and there's so many interesting things to talk about. You know, the open source world. You know, what are the firms like Bellingcat doing? You know, with artificial intelligence and open source, you know, the CIA has to justify, and there's a good reason to do so. We have to justify our existence. There's no doubt about it. And there is secret information to steal, and that's what we do, and we do well. But here's the bottom line is, you know, and I remember talking to a former director on this. Can you tell me, Jeff, what Syrian President Bashar al-Assad is thinking this morning? You can go down that, whether it's, you know, Russian President Putin, the Egyptian leadership. A lot of times we can't answer that in the affirmative. And if we can't answer that in the affirmative, we have to rethink the way we're doing things.
Absolutely.
And that's okay to do that. And as someone, look, and you know me, I mean, I speak and talk about intelligence matters. I'm a critic sometimes of the way we do things, but I love the organization and I love the profession. And I just want to see the place get better. But we have to be able to answer that question. And sometimes we can't. And so we, you know, and so maybe kind of bring back the Charlie Seidels of the world will allow us to do so.
Sometimes people forget that this is a life and death issue. We can't afford to have CIA leadership succumb to political winds and go along with a disastrous step like invading Iraq, which it'll be decades before that situation leavens to a degree that it's not really hurting us, and it may never happen. So how can we, is there a way that we can feel confident about the CIA holding firm on its intelligence? There were a lot of people who were opposed to the invasion of Iraq at CIA, and yet CIA went along with that. CIA has done that in the past in regard to Vietnam and other questions. These are disastrous mistakes. We're paying the intelligence community how many billions of dollars? Too many to count. To get this stuff right and to keep our political leaders on a short leash. So what's the outlook for you in terms of a revitalized CIA really being able to tell it straight to the president and others in these administrations?
Oh, so I actually do have a positive outlook. So, and I'll tell you that the CIA has made mistakes, and the CIA also has had tremendous successes that we don't hear about. And I know that's easy to say, but as someone who's, you know, if you come to my house and you go down to my basement and you see all the kind of the stuff on the wall of front page articles of the New York Times, these are operations that I ran that I can't talk about. So when I say, trust me, you know, that's, I just, but look, you make a good point. We have to learn from our errors, and you know, it's, I'm not going to just kind of blame it on the analyst about the analytic call of WMD, because it certainly was a collection issue as well. But we have learned from that. And I'll tell you that I had not retired yet. I was still in my seat as I was the acting operations chief, first the deputy and the acting operations chief over Europe and Eurasia, as the Trump administration took power. And so I saw the drafting and the fights, and of course the political fights over the intelligence community assessment on Russian interference. And I'll tell you, Jeff, that document was the gold standard of analysis. And the CIA stood really firm, even in the face of really strong attacks by the Trump administration against it. So I think we've come a long way, you know, where there's, because we can't be wrong on something that important. We shouldn't have been wrong on Iraq WMD. You know, we learned from it. There are a lot of, you know, reforms that are put in place. The CIA is going to get some calls wrong. That's just the nature of the business. But if you want to go kind of to the next big analytic call, which was Russian interference, the CIA nailed it, no doubt about it. And they stood by it. And, you know, and Gina Haspel, who her and I have not always seen eye to eye on certain things. But I really credit her for standing firm in the face of really strong attacks against the intelligence community from the Trump administration. So, you know, we're going to learn, we're going to make mistakes, we're going to learn. I know that the men and women who are there at the agency are great patriotic Americans. I will tell you, and maybe just to close this segment, you know, after 9/11, and so I focused on the Middle East, but really one of my specialties is on counterterrorism. And I'll tell you, after September 11th, there was a palpable feeling, especially amongst counterterrorism personnel, that we had failed. It's kind of trite, or maybe it's simplistic to say how bad we felt, but we really did. There certainly were warnings about Osama bin Laden, but the idea that we did not stop that attack was taken personally by everyone. And these are good people there. And so, you know, you reform, you kind of pull up your bootstraps and you go back at it. But I'm feeling, you know, much better now in terms of just on our processes, certainly than I did in the Iraq WMD, fiasco.
While we're on that subject, do you think that the most potent terrorist groups around now, ISIS and its affiliates and so on, have the ability to mount a 9/11 style attack again on this country?
Sure. So for me to say no would be incorrect, because, you know, no intelligence officer is going to say that. I think the United States has spent trillions after 9/11. And you can say we've bankrupted our country and we've taken our ball off our targets, such as Russia and China. But the bottom line is we did not allow for another attack to occur. And that's a credit to the men and women of the intelligence community. But you know, the world is made up of some bad actors, and there will be individuals who are seeking to hurt us. So it's entirely possible. So I think I think one of the real question is, as we make that pivot to China, Russia, to hard targets, and we have to, because there's no doubt that with the focus on counterterrorism, you know, we took our eye off the ball, and I'm as guilty as that as anybody else. But we can't forget that we're still in the CT fight, and we do have to, allocate resources and keep our partnerships up with the U.S. military and really with our allies overseas. The intelligence, the liaison relationships have been critical around the world in stopping attacks against Americans and our allies. So, you know, I guess the short answer is sure that there's still going to be people out there to do us harm, but we've done a lot to degrade kind of the core groups that were seeking these mass casualty attacks.
It seems to me that ISIS is metamorphosizing in Africa quite rapidly. That's quite worrisome, don't you think?
Yeah, sure. So I think that, and there's worrisome for two reasons. One is ungoverned spaces is the enemy of, what terrorist groups will gravitate towards. So just like Afghanistan was like that, in the Taliban years, where Al-Qaeda was able to use that as the base, the ungoverned spaces of Africa certainly are attractive to terrorist groups. There is a debate, and it's a legitimate one, on are these groups, you know, more of a threat regionally, or are they going to come after us in the United States? You can have a lot of discussions on that, because we do put a lot of time and money and effort and resources, and there's been American bloodshed in the CT fight in Africa. I think one of my worries is that we're going to take our eye off the ball in Africa so much in the pivot to hard targets, but it's going to be a fight over resources, and you see this played out. The U.S. military is kind of struggling what to do, in terms of their deployments with AFRICOM and the CT fight. And same thing with CIA. You know, there's a finite number of resources. I think there's an article today in the New York Times or yesterday about U.S. Special Forces teams in Mozambique, and so you know this is going to be a really interesting dilemma for us. I would argue that we can do both. We just have to do it smartly. A total shift to hard targets and neglecting CT is going to come back to haunt us. We don't want to do that.
Yeah. And it seems to me, again, this is where expertise, area expertise, language, cultural expertise is really paramount. If Bill Burns pushed a button tomorrow, counting on him actually arriving at CIA in the near future, if he pushed a button tomorrow and say, I want experts, I want to grow experts, how long is that going to take? Five years? 10 years?
I think there's several things. One is, you know, it's the pipeline in. So, okay, we bring a new operations officer in, we have to give them language training and then get them out in the field. So, you know, so how long does it take to have someone, and you know, as you have experience in this, you know, you knew what you were doing the day you left the country. So it's going to take maybe a tour or two or three before a case officer is really kind of, you know, operationally sharp and spot on. Maybe two tours, so, you know, we'll see. So it's going to take a number of years, but you could also bring back, you know, there are plenty of Middle Eastern specialists or Africa experts, perhaps as part of this generalist strategy, they're not in their old home office. Maybe you bring them back. There's also all sorts of other novel ways of doing things. And this is, trust me, this is not a plea for me, because I'm happily retired in Northern Virginia. I'm not going anywhere, but there's a lot of former intel officers out there who you could bring back. You know, we put a lot of people back on contract. You could bring them back into the fold, you know, as a stopgap measure. So there's certainly ways to do this, but you're right. It's just not pushing a button. It's going to take some time. I will say this. And, you know, I remember walking the halls of any division. And this is the Near East Division. That's kind of the legendary, at least in my mind, you know, the legendary landing spot of Arabists such as Charlie. There was a culture there. There was a camaraderie. There was a feeling of belonging. I didn't feel that when I left, and that's because there was kind of everyone kind of scattered, and there was this, you know, a view of producing generalists, and to going back to that culture of having that kind of, you know, family together. Of expertise in a certain region, I think is something that we should really do.
By the time you left, the family of experts had scattered.
Yeah. So, you know, I'd say that, you know, that we just didn't have that, you know, that deep bench because everyone was off. And, you know, so you do your tour in the Middle East, then you go to a tour in Europe, you do something on in counterterrorism, maybe counterproliferation. While in the past, you'd have just stuck and done three or four tours directly in that region.
And we can assume.
Sorry, go ahead.
And we can assume the same for China, which is emerging, has emerged as our biggest overall global challenge.
And it's not to say, so it's simplistic when people say we don't have any people who speak the language. We do. They just might be in serving somewhere else right now, you know, it's a shift in mindset on how we deploy our personnel. But there's no way Charlie Seidel, that those type of folks exist anymore now. And so I think that's to our detriment. I'll tell you that, you know, if you take a look, there's some great examples of situations in which look at the situation in Jordan, where we had King Hussein, a great U.S. ally, and then King Abdullah becomes, when King Hussein dies, King Abdullah becomes king, and is, you know, is relatively young at this time. You know, officers who serve in the region, who served in Jordan, perhaps under King Hussein, you know, think about the impact they would have with these rulers. And this is, you know, I'm not making a plug for you know, the aristocracy of monarchies, but you know, why wouldn't you want to keep people with relationships like this over the years? Same thing if it was in Egypt, or same thing in certainly in Saudi Arabia. One can make an argument even that if we had better expertise in Saudi Arabia, you know, we'd have better luck with than the craziness of Mohammed bin Salman and what MBS has done there. You wouldn't have the Jared Kushners of the world on WhatsApp, you know, encouraging this young neophyte who has kind of taken Saudi Arabia, many steps backwards. Bringing back that kind of expertise, I think in the long run is just smart.
Well, with that, we'll leave it. Mark, great to talk to you. Thanks very much for participating in Spy Talk. I've been talking with Mark Polymeropoulos, a 28-year veteran of the CIA clandestine service, most of it spent in the Middle East. For more provocative interviews like this, visit our Spy Talk page on Substack. You can easily find it via Google. And tune in to any of our other weekly installments of the Spy Talk podcast here or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Jeff Stein. See you around.
For more original reporting and insights like this, subscribe to spytalk.co on Substack and follow us on Twitter at @talk_spy. If you enjoyed our podcast, subscribe and leave a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.